episode 28 of the Tactical Breakdown podcast. Today we're talking technology-enhanced learning for law enforcement. Let's get into it.
Welcome to the Tactical Breakdown, a podcast for law enforcement, military, and emergency response professionals.
Stand by.
Where we help you bridge the gap and talk training, tactics, and leadership with the best subject matter experts in the world. Here is your host, Adam Kanakin.
Welcome to Tactical Breakdown. I'm your host, Adam Kanakin. This is the podcast for instructors and trainers if you are in law enforcement, the military, or emergency response. Today, I wanted to do a follow-up episode to episode 27 on science-based training, and I wanted to bring this one up because we're going to talk technology-enhanced training for law enforcement. So for today's episode, I'm bringing on a fellow Canadian and one of the co-founders and current president of the Canadian Police Knowledge Network, Mr. Sandy Sweet. Sandy's been an advocate for technology-enhanced learning within Canada's police community since 2004. He has a wealth of knowledge on this topic. I mean, this is all he's done the last 20 years. So it's really exciting to have Sandy on the show, and I hope you guys find this knowledge and information interesting and useful. So let's jump right into the episode. Here we go. All right, on the line, I have Mr. Sandy Sweet from CPKN, the Canadian Police Knowledge Network. Today, we're going to be talking all about technology-enhanced learning, online-based police training, and everything in between. So Sandy and I were talking prior to the interview here, and there was a few core concepts that we thought would be beneficial for instructors and trainers in law enforcement to discuss or hear more information about. One was the consistency in training. Better evaluating outcomes of training, certification courses for both patrol officers and instructors, and then developing a clear path for career planning, not only in law enforcement, but in the first responder community. So, Sandy, sir, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you jumping on the call, man.
Yeah, no, I'm excited, Adam. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this stuff. It's all near and dear to my heart. So, hopefully it'll be useful for your listeners.
Yeah, I really appreciate you jumping on the call. I was really interested when I got your bio here. You've been doing this for a long. How long have you been involved with technology enhanced learning and online training?
I used to introduce myself by saying I was never a police officer. I was never a trainer, and truth be known, I'm not that great an IT guy. So I started with CPKN. Well, it wasn't CPKN at the time. It was an idea back in 2002, really. And I thought I would do it for about a year and put together a business plan and a group of people who were keen on this. And I've just stuck with it ever since. And it's been a really interesting journey as not only the technology has evolved, certainly since 2002, but the buy-in from police trainers and police leaders and law enforcement writ large around using technology to speed up their time to competency. One of the key rules or lessons I learned very early was that e-learning, which is what we focused on initially and still is a big part of our organization and product line, e-learning is not the be-all and end-all, but it's a very useful tool when used appropriately and other aspects of technology-enhanced learning that have evolved since then. So, yeah, I've been doing this a long time. I've seen lots of changes, and I'm in many ways we're just at a point now where we're really going to see the benefits of this approach. We believe we're just scratching the surface. In the next 3 to 5 years, there's going to be an explosion in the way that law enforcement, first responders get the professional development they need when they need it.
I'm looking at your website and at cpkn.ca, and I can see that you guys have almost 200 courses on here, and the content providers are all of the major police departments around Canada. Where did CPKN get started? And the thing I think that everybody is interested in is the purpose of this type of platform isn't to take officers away from that in-person training and throw them strictly on a computer. It's to enhance what they're doing in the physical and face-to-face side of things and give them more information, right? So can you lay out a little bit about what the Canadian Police Knowledge Network is and how that got started?
Sure. I'll talk about the founding of CPCAN and then talk a little bit about the model, the cops teaching cops stuff. That is the second part of your question. There was federal government did a study on human resource development or professional development in policing back in year 2000, 20 years ago. And one of the recommendations coming out of that study, and it was exhaustive, it like they talked every police service in the country and did a very good job of creating a succinct report. But again, 20 years ago, some of the findings are still valid. But one of the recommendations was that the police community should come together and build a hub for sharing training and using this new way of doing things, which was e-learning, and there should be a shared resource. So a bunch of police services got together and said, can we do this? They were working with a guy by the name of John Arnold at the National Research Center, the Canadian Police Research Center. And John started bringing this group of 20, 25 people together for a couple of years to talk about collaboration and what it could look like. I was hired by a community college here in Prince Edward Island to do something similar. They have a police academy, the Atlantic Police Academy, and they wanted to get into online training. And we came across some startup money. So we jammed the two ideas together, the project I was working on for Holland College and John Arnold's project, and we called it the Canadian Police Knowledge Network. When we launched in October 2004, we had four courses in the catalog. And I think two of them we borrowed from other providers. I think we only had two that we had built ourselves. But what's evolved, Adam, since that time, you know, 2004, this October, we had our 15th anniversary. We have, as you say, like over 200 courses in the catalog. We have over 100,000 registered users on our LMS. Have become really a part of the fabric of Canadian police training. We don't do it all, but the part we do, we think we do very well. And we've also, in the last 3 to 5 years, become this hub for sharing course training standards, sharing content. We have something called the National Police Training Inventory, where organizations post all the training they have, not just e-learning, but really their course catalog out of their training unit. And so we would have the RCMP, Toronto Police Service, Vancouver, there you go, all the large Ontario Police College. And so if some trainer is looking for something on sexual assaults or de-escalation, whatever it is, they don't have to start from scratch building a course. They can go on to MPTI, see that there's already five courses available. One of them is a week long in a classroom. Another one is, 4 hours online, 2 days in a classroom. This other one is, 4 hours online standalone. And they can, depending on what the needs of their service are, they can contact the people who have already built those courses and say, hey, can you share your content? I want to build a course that is aimed at this part of my police service. And we think it's going to be 2 days in a classroom. We want a real practical, hands-on approach. So it allows the trainers not to start from scratch. They have some place to go where there's already training created. That's MPTI is part of what we do. It's actually, I believe it's an underutilized resource, but it kind of typifies, if you will, Adam, the approach that CPCAN uses to collaboration within the Canadian police community. We have, it started out as these 20, 25 like-minded police trainers and leaders back in the early 2000s. But now we have a board of directors that's made up of police leaders from across the country, typically chiefs, deputy chiefs of large cities or large city police services or police training leaders from large services. And they provide the governance and the strategic direction for CPCAN. And we have another group called the National Advisory Committee, which is about 16, 18 people from across the country who, again, are representative of Canadian policing and are typically closer to the coal face when it comes to being responsible for training in their organization. So, you know, the head of the Ontario Police College, the director from the Justice Institute of BC, the head of training for Edmonton Police Service, that sort of thing. And what these advisory committee people, they really drive the business of CPCAN, and they identify priority training needs. They identify new technology that's out on the horizon, and they identify research that we should be doing, and they help direct the activities of the 25 staff members that we have here on site in Charlottetown PEI. So, you know, over the years from 2004, when we first launched to now, the business model or the organizational model has evolved and grown and become more rigorous, if you will. And, you know, this organization, as I said earlier, has become part of the fabric of Canadian police training. And, you know, we don't take that for granted. It's, you know, it's an ever evolving landscape out there, and through the, you know, the staff members we have here who do a lot of outreach, the National Advisory Committee and the Board of Directors, we try to stay connected with the needs of the police services in this country. And, you know, it's the Canadian Police Knowledge Network, but probably 40% of our work is done with federal and provincial agencies like Canadian Border Security Agency or Corrections or CSIS. We do a lot of work with National Defense and similarly with provincial, you know, wildlife, natural resource kind of people, and anybody involved in enforcement and investigations. So it's about police, law enforcement, and public safety partners.
That's awesome. And one of the things that I picked up on there when you were explaining what it was, you talked about this MPTI, the training database that you guys have. Is that something that is available only to officers in Canada? Or if you are from a Commonwealth country or even from the United States, are they able to access those modules, or do they have to go through you guys and try to figure that out?
Yeah, it's not just it's protected behind it's password protected. But if somebody wanted access and was associated with a police service, we would get them access. We want to know what they think about it as much as anything. But if they can benefit from it, that's fine too. We typically, Adam, we do some work internationally. We have some client organizations outside of Canada, but most of our focus is on the Canadian context. But we don't say no to anybody. We're doing some work right now with some people in Australia around some competency framework that we have, and they're updating their competency framework, and so there's some cross-pollination there. For example, I've been to Ukraine a couple of times. We created something called the Ukrainian Police Knowledge Network. Canada does a lot of, as other countries do a lot of development work in Ukraine, helping them out. And so we went over and put a fledgling CPCAN or UPCAN in place, and they're still using it now. That was a couple of years ago. I was over there. So we do a little bit of work internationally, but we focus more on Canadian context. But we don't, you know, anybody who is a legitimate law enforcement first responder, we don't turn them away.
What I'm gonna make sure I do is we'll have a link or some way for people to contact you or CPKN to get access to that if they're either in Canada or anywhere else in the world. So we'll make sure that we can link them and connect them up with you. And if you're interested in that kind of stuff, as long as you're active duty or an active member of a law enforcement agency, and I think if you reach out with your agency's email, I think you should be okay, right? Is that right, Sandy?
Yeah, that's the best identifier right there. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, awesome. So when we jump into it and we start talking about the consistency of training, how does a platform like this assist in creating a consistency in training across the board?
Well, it's a great question. And one of the things we found early on, and I'm talking 15 years ago, we built a course on domestic violence investigations with a police service in Winnipeg, in your hometown. And when we tried to get police services in other parts of the country to adopt it, they said, no, we do it differently here. And, I was very new to policing. I kind of scratched my head and thought, hold it now, isn't domestic violence investigation a domestic violence investigation? The principles must be similar. If not 100% the same, they must be similar. That was 2004. Now, that course actually is still being used, and it's been updated, but we've also learned a few tricks. Like, you don't just have Winnipeg police officers depicted in the course. You make sure you make police officers or law enforcement people recognize themselves in the courseware. But now when we build courses, and I talked about the National Advisory Committee, what we do is we build courses for a national audience. So we've learned over time to not just work necessarily with a subject matter expert from a content provider from one police service, but you might do, four or five police services with their subject matter experts, and you build a more robust course that will have more consistency nationally, and therefore more buy-in from the community. So you build it once, you use it many times, and by getting away from the model of just working with one police service, we've created more attractive courses, or more courses that are attractive to a broader base. Policing is local, so you're always going to have to tweak the course somewhat for the local standard operating procedures or size of the city, urban, rural, those types of things. But again, I come back to a comment you made earlier that I didn't comment on, like the courses we have in our catalog are, some of them are standalone. They're meant to be an online training course. Most of our courses now are, we used to build long courses, but most of them now are 45 minutes to a couple of hours is a long course at this point in time. It's trying to replace what a police officer would be exposed to in a day in a classroom, let's say, or half a day. So, but some police services take that same course and they use it as a blended learning event where they tell their officers, we want you to take that course. And then next Wednesday, we're going to meet for a day and we're going to talk about the material that was in that course. And that's where the learning will be reinforced and evaluated. So, sometimes the courses are purpose built to be blended. So, instead of going on a course for 2 weeks, you might do a knowledge transfer representing about a week of the course. And then the second week you would actually go to the Ontario Police College or JIBC, whatever. And everybody shows up on day one with the same level of knowledge. And so it really creates a more effective second week of training, as again, the knowledge points are reinforced. There could be role playing, there could be hands-on activity, and the evaluation happens in real time. So those are the kinds of learning solutions, I guess, that we have in our catalog.
When you talk about building out these programs that are universal across the country, it sounds almost more like, I would rather almost use the term standardization over consistency when we're talking about building out a standardized program, whether it's used as blended learning or as a standalone course. But it's something that if you're in BC, if you're in Central Canada, or if you're on the East Coast, they're getting the same information. Is that the goal of this platform?
Yeah, and it used to be back in the day, if you talked about national standards, you would get shot. Well, People didn't like it. People didn't like it very much. And in Canada, in the U.S., I my belief is it's similar. But in Canada, policing is a provincial responsibility. And so every province has a police act that outlines the training requirements to be a police officer in that province. So it's when you're building national standards, you need all those provinces and jurisdictions to buy into the standard that you've created. And, you know, in this country, sometimes it works and sometimes there's outliers. And then you have your big city, you know, the Toronto's with 7,000 or 8,000 police officers, and you have Kentville, Nova Scotia with 15 police officers. Obviously, Kentville's not going to build their own training standards, but Toronto can. And if they don't like what they're seeing in the rest of the country, they'll just go their own way if it doesn't meet their needs. And it's hard to argue with them because they have, you know, three daily newspapers and media outlets there making sure that they're doing a good job. But what we've done with our structure around the National Advisory Committee and, as I alluded to before, we're not just about technology enhanced learning or e-learning now. Our National Advisory Committee looks at course training standards to make sure that we're using the same approach of identifying learning objectives, of outlining material, of building evaluation strategies. And if you build it once for, you know, de-escalation, you should be able to use that same training effectively in other parts of the country, because it's not really based on legislation, if you will. It's about human interaction. And so we are finding, Adam, over time that more and more of the courses are becoming highly consistent and therefore the standard, if you will. But we try not to lead with the idea that we're trying to create standards. What we're trying to create is consistency, and the standard will follow.
One of the key reasons why I created this podcast and this platform, as we've discussed, and if you're listening to this, you've probably heard me say this multiple times already now, but the reason was to kind of get rid of that insular training or insular idea of these are our toys. We don't want to share them between agencies, between instructors. And it sounds like what you're doing is you're finding those agencies, you're finding those people that are comfortable sharing what they've created and saying, hey, listen, we've already put the work in. Take it and run with it, right? And make it better, change it however you need. But here's the groundwork. We've already done it. Why do people have to keep going back over and over? And every agency shouldn't have to create something from scratch. And it sounds like you guys have really kind of rounded the corner on that and have created a platform that agencies and people can access and be like, you know what? I don't have to build this out from scratch. I mean, one of the biggest things for me is, I mean, collaboration, working with other instructors. I don't know where I would be if I had to start building out programs by myself. Like you can't do it, right? Not everybody's somebody that can start and build out a complete program from nothing, right? There's not a lot of people in the world that can do that. And you always have to start from somewhere. So it's nice to see that there's some place that instructors can go to and be like, you know what? Okay, I have to build out a DT program, or I have to build out something like a firearms training program, or a crowd management program, or something. They can come to your site. They can come to your database and be like, all right, here's three or four. You know, I've looked through them all. I like this one the best. I'm going to work off this one and go from there. It seems like you've really taken a lot of the guesswork out of like you said, standardizing and making these types of training consistent so that they work the best for each individual agency.
Yeah. And, you know, not, we still have room to grow and get better at this. But collectively, you know, we've come a long way. And, you know, when you get excited about this is when people are reaching out to, whether it's staff members or people on the National Advisory Committee, and saying, can you, does anybody have anything on resiliency training? You know, when we built when cannabis was legalized in Canada in October 17th, 2018, the RCMP, who was responsible, and Public Safety Canada, who were responsible for training all police officers in the country, came to us and said, can you build something that is standard right across the country so that we know if, from a liability perspective, we know that every frontline officer is getting the same training. And so it's not like Saskatchewan has to build theirs and Nova Scotia has to build theirs and they were going to run into trouble with in the courts. So we took that on and it was interesting in that I was recently at a conference with a Canadian Association Chiefs of Police conference. And it was interesting how many chiefs and deputy chiefs came up to me and said, well, thank you for doing that. Cause other than that, we were cooked. We would have had to build our own and we had no idea how we were going to do it. And this way they had access to, courseware that had been validated by a very broad section of not only subject matter experts, but we had probably 50 or 60 people who were just reviewers who, you know, took the product and critiqued it. So by the time we launched, you know, it was a pretty solid product. So yeah, but you know, standards consistency, we go back and forth on that, but the idea is why spend resources? Why should a police service or any organization spend resources building something that where it already exists? You can take it and tweak it, but don't build it from the ground up.
Yeah, one of the other things that you had mentioned too, and we talked just briefly about, was blended learning. And I found that everything that I do now involves blended learning in one way, shape, or another. For example, if we're going to be doing kind of a use of force or DT program, I have an online module package that I can send out to the students prior to them ever stepping foot inside the class, because time is the biggest issue for any trainer, right? We all wish we had more time with the students. So blended learning gives you the ability to, you know, here's all the academics that I want you to know as a groundwork for coming to the course. And when we start teaching the physical skills, I can reference now the academic portion that you should already have some basic comprehension of. And it saves time kind of going through it step by step in class and chewing up those valuable time, right? So I think the blended learning way of teaching is by far the best thing that we have out there right now. I don't know if you have a different opinion on that or.
No, I think that is the one that where people can readily see the value of the online portion. I mean, I'm sure there's people listening or who will be listening to this who are use of force instructors, and use of force instructors are typically very focused, very passionate and protective of their learning objectives and the way that they go about things.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, right. No, it's just something I noticed once or twice. Yeah, but we had an event in Toronto, I think it was 2010. It was a while ago, a G8. And it turned, you know, so police officers had to come to Toronto from all over Canada, really, RCMP, the Ontario Provincial Police, the Toronto City Police, obviously, but all the other, you know, Hamilton, London, everybody. There's like 16,000 police officers from, you know, three or four dozen different organizations. And they all had to be exposed to some similar tactics with respect to how they were going to be deployed. And it fell to the Toronto Police Service, their use of force people to train everybody. And Toronto came to us and we built an upfront module that all 16,000 people could get through in advance. And so then they came in really to be certified, I'd say, to be evaluated on whether or not they understood what they saw online. And then they, you know, they do some drills or some practice activities, that sort of thing. So I saw that. I was at a conference a couple months later, and it was the head instructor said, I had no idea. I couldn't believe that this was going to work. This was the silliest thing I had ever heard. And he said, those were the best cohorts, of best classes of students that I've ever seen, because they came in with the knowledge. And all you were doing was was reinforcing that and evaluating that and saying, yes, you got it, off you go. So, you know, when you blend the two modes together, then you as a police leader, as somebody who's responsible for the quality of the professional development that is required in your officers, you get a great sense of confidence around this is the best and coincidentally the fastest way to that competency that you're looking for.
Do you know Darwin Tetreault by chance?
No.
I had an interview with him, and he does the public order policing for RCMP out of their HQ in Ottawa. We had a whole discussion on public order, and we talked about the Olympics in Vancouver. We talked about the G8s, G20s, when those type of major events come in, and some of the difficulties that they have when, like you said, you have officers from around the country coming in, working together collaboratively in these major groups, and you have to somehow get them all on the same page. This sounds exactly like something that would be extremely beneficial, and has been beneficial for those types of events. So it's really neat to see how that ties together.
Yeah.
One of the other things that you'd said, though, and you kind of led right into the next thing that we were going to talk about, which is evaluating outcome. So I'll just let you take the stage on kind of finishing off that idea.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. The when we started out, what one of the knocks against e-learning was, how do you know it works? And hey, it's a great question. How do you know it works? So, you know, you do your pre-test and your post-test, and you measure the gain in terms of knowledge transfer. You can do it 6 months later, see if it's sticky or not. Like, there's ways around that. We didn't have any of those ways initially, and we still don't. We collectively don't do enough evaluation. But the conversation has turned over the years to, how do we know traditional training works? Like, how do you know that police officers actually benefit from going through these training sessions, and that it, again, it's sticky and it changes their behavior in the ways you're looking for. So what we've been talking about a lot, we do an annual conference here on Prince Edward Island, and we bring in police leaders and trainers from across the country. And we had one speaker last October talking about the neuroscience of learning. And he basically said, you know, if you're trying to teach people anything more than a 5 minute snippet, you've lost them. They're distracted. They're thinking about something else. And he walked us through this hour and a half, or almost hour and a half, exercise. And sure enough, he reinforced these ideas that maybe the way we do training isn't the way that our brains learn. Which really, you know, there was a lot of people in the room who've been doing training for 30 years, and they thought, is my career wasted? Like, what's that all about? But I think, Adam, obviously, we have lots of great trainers, we have lots of great training programs and institutions around in the sector. And I think the speaker was trying to make a point, which was, don't just rely on the fact that this is the way you've done it, that you know that it works. How do we build evaluation programs that validate the amount of time and energy that we're putting into our training programs? And again, it comes back, part of it might be consistency. If you have a good course training standard and you have a good instructor, then you're probably going to get consistent outcomes in terms of your training, regardless of where that training occurs. But you need the evaluation to prove it. And more, you know, when there's a public inquiry into some issue between police and the public, training is one issue that always comes up. It's always part of, you know, if a firearm was used, what sort of use of force training did you get? What kind of firearms training? And how do you know it worked? You know, so evaluation, I think, is something collectively, whether we're talking technology enhanced learning, I mean, now we're getting into, you know, simulators and virtual reality and all kinds of neat tools how do we know they work? You know, so evaluation, regardless of what mode of training you're using, I think is where we really have to collectively up our game and be able to demonstrate to each other that the training that we're advocating is rock solid and will get you the outcomes that are supposed to come out of it. There was a study done by Dr. Laura Huey, H-U-E-Y. She's out of Ivy in London, Ontario, Western University in London, Ontario. And she did a study about a year and a half ago, I'll say late 2018 or early 2019, on research done on police training in Canada. And what she found was there was very little. And so we do not pay enough attention, I believe, to the science of the neuroscience of training and learning and the evaluation of our various programs to make sure that they're actually hitting their mark. So I think it's a risk that police leaders, like police chiefs who get hit with the liability issues that come out of, I'll say poor performance, but you know what I mean by that, by somebody making a mistake because they weren't trained appropriately. What I believe one of the forces that is going to affect all of us in the future and is already affecting all of us is the need to be able to say, this is the training we developed. Here's the evaluation mechanism we use. This is how we know it works. And, we're passionate about that now, but we're passionate about that here, but we know we have to continue to get better at that.
We have a instructors roundtable. It's going to be a live conversation with four instructors last Thursday of every month. And one of the things that got brought up for the first one that we're having on the 30th, it's going to be on use of force and defensive tactics. One of the questions that got brought up and one of the topics that an instructor would like the panel to discuss was analytics and legacy data. And that is exactly what you're talking about there, is that for the longest time, if the only judge of whether or not your training was effective was, did we have any incidents or not, right? It wasn't, did anybody get hurt or not? Or did we have, if we had five incidents this year and two incidents the next year, then obviously the training's working because we had less incidents. But we're starting to find that that's obviously not the case. And, it's every situation is different, but we're just starting now to track the analytics, starting to track this legacy data going back. And when people are starting to peel back the layers, like you're saying, and researching, I haven't read Dr. Huey's study. I'm going to do that right after we're off this call. But when people are doing this research, they're starting to find all this really interesting information. And it's showing that maybe we weren't doing things the right way, or maybe things weren't being retained as well as we thought they were. Is that kind of fit into what you were saying?
Well, I think one of the great things about the advances in technology is that we are able to manage data much better than we could. And whether you're using tools like simulators where you can measure outcomes, or you're using a rubric and a subjective observation of scenario-based training that somebody's going through a crime scene village or whatever, but still you're able to harvest the data from that and be able to understand how well your training is happening, how well it's meeting the learning objectives, and how much you're modifying people's behavior. There's some great work actually being done in RCMP Depot. Dr. Greg Kratzik has done a lot of work around using simulators in use of force training. He started out with just firearms training and, comparing people who trained on their weapon using a simulator versus another group cohort that would use traditional live fire, real guns, real bullets. And what he found was that the people using a simulator, right up until the time they had to do their qualification which was done with live fire, they actually learned better how to use their firearm, because quite simply, they could do it more often. They just, and because everything was being monitored, the instructor could find out what mistakes they were making and help them modify those mistakes. So, you know, I think again, the analytics is what's really key there, and making good evidence-based decisions about how we modify our training programs and training standards. Dr. Greg Anderson at the Justice Institute of British Columbia is doing some good work about police officers and how they make decisions under stress. And Greg, he's done some work for us here at CPGAN, but his background is in training Olympic athletes. So they measure everything down to the nth degree, and they track every little bit of data, and they're looking for just minor or seemingly almost insignificant improvements, but he measures those increments, and he can then validate different methodologies and tell you what kind of gain or loss you're going to get in terms of the desired outcome. So those are just a couple of examples of ways that I think getting academic and scientific or evidence-based decisions around how we build training programs is an advance in terms of the consistency, in terms of the evaluation, and in terms of the what we really want. We need subject matter experts, but we also need these educators to help us build courses that and programs that we know are effective, and we can demonstrate are effective for the liability issues.
I know that I can speak from personal experience that simulators are effective for firearms training. Obviously, with the Canadian Forces, we do use a lot of simulator training. And the main reason behind it being that, you know, we don't have the budget to expend live rounds every single time we want to pick up our weapon. So the simulators allow us to put soldiers through courses of fire daily if we wanted to, without that overhead cost and expenditure of actually using live rounds on the range. So it can be extremely effective. And I would also term that as blended learning as well. I mean, going back to the blended learning, it's, you know, just, you know, it's just because you don't have the live fire doesn't mean that they get used to having the weapon in their hand. They get used to functioning that weapon and clearing stoppages and doing all the drills that they need to get comfortable. And with also, for some people, I mean, when you take somebody who's never held a automatic firearm before, there is a set of nerves that's there where sometimes people are nervous or they feel unsafe, and it affects their ability to focus and actually learn and retain information versus a purely academic arena where they know that there is nothing in that room that can hurt them, so that they're not uncomfortable with the firearm, right? Yeah, I mean, you see it in firearms safety courses. Obviously, the firearm is unloaded. There's nothing in the firearm, but people still, like, you watch somebody who's never picked up a handgun before, and they start sweating, they get nervous, and these are civilians. But I mean, to get into policing or law enforcement, you start off as a civilian. So those are the people that are coming through the door. So there is, I think there's a huge benefit in simulator training for that purpose alone.
Yeah. No, and I, you know, I don't know if in your armed forces days, Tim Workman, he was a major, worked out of New Brunswick. He talked a lot about time to competence, you know, it was using all the technology you could, but at the end of the day, you had to have that skill and had to be able to demonstrate that skill. But the tools, the training tools allowed you to get there more quickly, and also as you just alluded to, more cheaply, which is a consideration for sure in this.
Yeah. When we talk about certifying instructors and then building these courses out to, I mean, we could talk about the difference between certification and qualification probably for 2 weeks, but we'll leave that on the back burner for now. But when we're talking about certifying officers and instructors and what types of things that they should be going through, what are your thoughts on that requirement?
Well, it's interesting. What what we've done is relied on subject matter experts to build training and sometimes also deliver that training. And I used to work with this guy who is staff superintendent for the Toronto Police Service, Darren Smith. He's passed away now, but he was a larger than life kind of guy. And he talked about the difference between a subject matter expert, a curriculum developer who works with that person to really chunk the training up into learning objectives and material and evaluation. But, you know, so taking from the subject matter expert the things that the curriculum developer would need to build an effective course, really identifying who the target audience is and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, assuming, let's say this is a face-to-face course, you then hand that off to an instructor who would deliver the course in including the evaluation to the classroom of students. Those are different skill sets all along the path, and we used to mix them all together. So you need people you need a course that has been gone through an evaluation, like the actual course has gone through an evaluation process in how it was designed and created and approved. And so that's one piece of certification. It could be that subject matter expert, or maybe you want that subject matter expert doing what they do, right? You don't want them tied up all the time doing training. And then when you have the instructor, it's got to be somebody who knows how to instruct. So it's more of an educator than a practitioner, if you will. It could be a practitioner, but they better understand how you educate a room full of 24 police officers. And so that's where, you know, where discussions we're having collectively with our National Advisory Committee and our Board of Directors. And, you know, and I'm involved with the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm the co-chair of their training subcommittee. We're trying to look at making sure that we're building training that's defensible, that it's effective and defensible. And one way it's defensible is if you, all along that path from creation to delivery, you have people who are good at what they do, and you can demonstrate that with some sort of certification or qualification. An example, again, I was at RCMP Depot a couple of years ago, and the lead firearms instructor was talking about he had to go to court because one of the Mounties shot somebody. And so, of course, his training came up during the inquiry. And he said, no, this is what I did, and I followed my training. And what they found out was he did follow his training. And they went back to the instructor, and they said to the instructor, this is what he said he was trained on. The guy said, yeah, that's the way I did it. And the lead instructor said, are you kidding me? That's not our program. He said, yeah, I just threw that in, you know. So obviously, like, there was a breakdown there in terms of what was a certified course, and that instructor, who pretty quickly was no longer an instructor, I'll say failed in their professional duty to deliver that exact course exactly every time. And so that's, you know, I think there's some is a recurring theme in this discussion we're having, Adam. But I think that, you know, the liability issue to organizations is huge. So trainers, you know, those of us responsible for professional development in the sector have to be really good at what we do. And we have to be able to demonstrate to an outside party, because the only time they're going to look at us is when something goes wrong, that we know what we're up to. And that certification is something that is, you know, I'm not advocating for you got to have a master's in education or whatever, but I don't think it's just anybody who could stand in front of a classroom, take a course outline and deliver that. It's got to be somebody who knows what they're doing.
I think it goes back to the old adage that good players don't always make good coaches.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this has come up on a few different episodes and conversations that I've had with other instructors. And I personally believe that there should be some educational component to every instructor trainer program, that you know, modalities of learning should be in every, I don't care what you're teaching, whether it be use of force or you're teaching computer science or you're teaching first aid. Everybody should understand the modalities of learning and how people learn so that they can best instruct them in a classroom setting. I think every instructor should have to go through that because, like you Yep. said, you don't necessarily need to have, you know, a master's in education, but you have to know how, you have to learn how to teach. I mean, from when I can, you know, I had this conversation with Tony Blauer. When I first started out as a use of force and defensive tactics instructor, I thought I knew everything. You know, I came in there because I had, you know, I had never been in a situation that I couldn't handle. All my real world experience and all the fights and all the incidents that I've been involved with, I never had an issue. But that was because I had done the training and I had spent the time working on myself to be able to function and do that effectively. But now when you have somebody like me, who's 6 foot, 220 pound male, that's been in athletics his whole life, and now I'm trying to teach techniques to a 140 pound female and she's 5 foot nothing. Mm-hmm. Well, things change pretty freaking quickly. And if you don't know how to relay information in a different way than you learned it yourself, you have a very, very hard time as an instructor to get that person to retain any of that knowledge or information or make it useful to them, especially in like a defensive tactics type setting. So I think to kind of piggyback on what you said, I think it's extremely important that anybody who wants to become an instructor should actively be searching for ways to learn about education and learn how to teach other people that may learn differently than themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. No, well said. Well said.
Do you, when we talk about building out career paths and planning careers for people that move up, you know, from recruit to officer to instructor to, you know, sergeant, inspector, chief, when we start building out this career plan, how does e-learning come into play with that? Because from my experience with the Canadian Forces, again, is what I'm going to draw from, is even as a junior officer, we were always involved in e-learning or DL type courses that were one up or two levels up from where we currently were, so that when we got to that next level, we already had that information and knowledge Right. available to us. So you want to walk me through your thoughts on developing your career path?
Yeah. And Adam, it's not just about e-learning in this context. So the Canadian Police Knowledge Network owns something called a competency-based management framework. This was it's more than just a framework. There's a whole bunch of intellectual property around competency-based management that was created by the Canadian Police Sector Council. And when they were no longer funded back in the 2013 or 14, we became the custodian of this framework. And what it does is it brings you right from basic constable training through to leadership training and or leadership competencies for chiefs and deputy chiefs. And so in my mind, and what we're talking about, a career path that takes you through those various levels in the organization that you outlined, but it shows you what that path looks like. So if you're a constable and you want to be a sergeant, and you know, a sergeant in Charlottetown PEI with in an organization of 60 people is a little bit different than a sergeant in Toronto of an organization of 7,000 or 8,000 people. So there's competencies and there's levels of proficiency that are mapped out there. But you should, as an individual, if you aspire to be a chief in your organization, you should understand what that career path looks like and what competencies you have to acquire and demonstrate in order to be accepted or considered for promotion to the next level, And what you talked about, Adam, where you were preparing in advance for your next promotion, doesn't happen in every organization in the sector in this country, in the policing or public sector. A lot of times people in some organizations are still promoted because, you know, they've been around long enough that they understand the promotional process and they get promoted and then they get trained to do their job as opposed to demonstrating the competence and then applying for the job and competing with other people. So, you know, I think we're at the process, the framework that I outlined has been around a long time. It's being used sporadically and there's other frameworks around that police services in this country are using. But what we're finding is, and we've been doing a lot of outreach with the community and a couple of workshops and surveys and that sort of thing. And actually, we have a workshop next week in Ottawa around leadership competencies where we're validating that chunk of the framework. But what we're finding is people are using them for promotion, for hiring initially, but selection, promotion, retention, identifying professional development needs, mapping, allowing people to map their career path with a framework in their organization and making them aware of what the needs are before they apply for the next level. But everybody's doing it a little bit differently or independently. So it's really siloed when it comes to competency-based management. And what we're trying to do is breathe life back into this framework as a national tool and have a consistent approach. So if you're a police officer on either end of the country, you have a career path that you can identify. And it's pretty consistent with your colleagues on the other part of the country, which, the framework itself was to go back to that. What the sector council did was bring in police from all over Canada to build out this beast. They spent 7 years and about $8 or $10 million of travel and consulting and meetings and to make sure there was broad base input into this tool. So that's what I talk about. So e-learning is part of that. So aren't university courses. So aren't other professional development opportunities you have. So aren't just going to work every day and getting better at your job. You know, coach officer evaluations, your annual performance evaluation, all those things can factor into your career path and getting you to where you want to be, or understanding where you got to get better to get where you want to be. So that's what I mean by that. So we're, you know, CPGAN is that's part of our mandate that is outside of pure professional development, if you will.
One of the things I was really excited to ask you about is your Canadian Credible Leadership course, because that kind of flows into what we were just talking about. And if you're a junior officer listening to this, or, you know, even if you're an instructor or sergeant and your aspirations are to move up the chain, I mean, leadership training, like we've already brushed on earlier in this talk, isn't something that just happens. You have to actively either seek it out or have it delivered to you by your agency or department. And there's a lot of steps when involved with that. And you guys have come up with an extensive course. I mean, you had mentioned when we first started talking that the average course that you guys have is 45 minutes to 3 hours, 3 hours being on the long end. This thing's like 60 hours. So what is this course? Where did it come from, and how can people get a hold of it?
It's a great question, and we are really excited about this course. So there's a school in Durham, North Carolina, the International Academy of Public Safety, who worked with an academic by the name of Dr. Terry Anderson. This was Terry's life work, and he wrote a book called Every Police Officer is a Leader. And Dr. Mitch Javidi liked the book, got Terry to drop it into an online format that was accessible to people, easily accessible to people across the U.S. So that's called Credible Leadership. Terry happens to be a Canadian. He's from British Columbia from the West Coast, taught at university out there before he met Mitch. So some police officers in BC got interested in it, took the credible leadership course, field tested it, said, it's great, we like the concepts, but we don't like, you know, it's not quite right for a Canadian context. So what we've done over the course of the last, I'll say 18, 24 months, is taken that credible leadership course and, you know, use different, it's all the same concepts, but we use different examples, different videos, different learning activities, and created the Canadian Credible Leadership Course, which, as you say, is 60 hours online. There's 60 individual skills that are packaged into four modules. The intent is not to start on a Monday morning and finish on Saturday afternoon, and you know, you turn anybody into a leader. It's to take some parts of the course, like a module, let's say, that might have 12 skills in it, and learn those skills. Typically, it's an hour per skill, but put them into practice. Like, you know, it's not just about knowledge transfer. It's about giving you skills that you can actually use in your workplace. Or I heard a guy last week on a webinar we did, he was doing a testimonial. He loved this course, and he said it helped him with his marriage, which actually didn't survive. So it helped him with his divorce. But now he and his ex-wife can co-parent their kids because he has better skills in terms of managing that interpersonal, and obviously a difficult interpersonal situation. So you can go to our website, cpgan.ca, and there's a description of Canadian Credible Leadership Course, and you can take a look at the description. There's a name on there, Randy Cameron, that you can give Randy a call, and he can explain it more fully. American listeners, I would say go to iaps.org or Google Credible Leadership, and you'll find Mitch or Terry. And I know that they've had great success in the U.S. They've had, you know, how this, Adam, ties into what the discussion we just had is that this Credible Leadership Course, it can be for constables who are just entering their career, and it gives you all the basics around leadership and gives you skills that you can use in your job, at home, whatever. You're going to get better. It's complementary to other professional development programs that that might be available to you through your police service or whatever on your own. It's also good for people who've been around a long time and just want to be refreshed, or heaven forbid, some of us need some rehabilitation in our leadership skills. So it is not a course that you're going to go and, as I said, just consume the 60 hours and think that you're going to be a better leader. You have to really embrace it. There's a book that comes with it, an ebook that you can download. And what we're trying to do is set up cohorts across Canada where we'll have ability to do a community of practice or a webinar with police leaders involved, so people can again get the learnings from the course reinforced. So it's pretty exciting. We just launched in August, and I don't know, you know, our user base is a few hundred at this point in time, but the interest is picking up, and I think it is a real good foundation for anybody who wants to be better in their job.
I think it's going to be a great resource, not only your version, but for our friends in the U.S. for the IAPS program as well, their credible leadership program. So anybody listening to this, they can go to cpkn.ca. That's Charlie Papa Kilo November.ca, because we're up here in Canada, obviously. Listen, Sandy, I appreciate you taking the time today, my man. I know we covered a lot of topics, but I think that everybody kind of got the idea of what you were doing, and I think they understand a little bit better about the e-learning platforms and the blended learning and how it's actually starting to change the way that we look at leadership and training and policing. So thank you for being here, dude.
No, it was wonderful. Great conversation, Adam. I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah.
Well, I look forward to some collaboration here in the future. And obviously we'll talk offline and have that come down the pipe later on for everybody. All the things that we talked about in today's episode are going to be available on the show notes page. So make sure to check that out. You can click it on your podcast player or visit us on the website to get all those links to CPKN, to all of those different things, the training database that we spoke to earlier. So everybody will have access to all that right off our website and make it easy to find you guys. So.
All right.
Cool, man. Well, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day and we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Adam. All right. Take care.
All right. That wraps up my episode here with Sandy. If you want to learn more about Sandy, what he's doing and what they're doing over at CPKN, check out the show notes on your app. Go to the breakdown.ca/028 and all the links, all of the information will be there for you. Super simple. I'm excited also to let everybody know that we are going to be at ILETA. The ILETA Conference and Expo taking place the 23rd to 28th of March in St. Louis. We are going to be down there. We're going to have everything set up. We're going to be doing podcasts. We're going to be doing interviews with guests of the conference, with attendees, with speakers, with vendors, everybody who wants to come over, say hi, book, or get a hold of me beforehand and book in a spot. We'll get you set up for an interview. Really excited to meet you face to face, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So we'll see you in St. Louis. Make sure to like and subscribe to the podcast if you are finding this information actionable and useful. And I hope to see you next time on the Tactical Breakdown. Stay safe.